At the same time, some of you may be thinking, some of you may be feeling that all this has a familiar ring. Burning oneself, offering oneself up as a sort of sacrifice in this way, it's as though we'd heard it all before. And very likely we have, not so very many years ago. Because there was, you may remember, the case or the cases of those Vietnamese monks who some years ago burned themselves in Vietnam. And some of you might even have seen the pictures. I myself remember seeing, I was in India at the time, pictures of these monks burning themselves, and one of them in particular was very, very impressive, I remember. And I saw it in colour. And it depicted an elderly monk. Well, not only elderly, he was old. He was well over 70. And he was sitting cross-legged on the ground. And there was a car not very far away. It was apparently in the open street. And he was blazing. He was absolutely on fire. Apparently he'd soaked himself in petrol. But he was just sitting there as though meditating. He was perfectly upright, features were perfectly calm, just as though he was meditating. And this American cameraman happened to be on the spot, just happened to be passing by, and he took this picture. And this old man left, apparently, a letter behind saying why he was doing this, and apparently did it, completely self-possessed, completely calm, and completely mindful. So if you saw this picture, or if you even heard about this incident or other incidents, there were seven altogether, including one nun, you may have wondered why they did it. Why did they set themselves on fire in this way? Well, the reason was very simple. They did it because they wanted to draw attention to the fact that in Vietnam there was no religious freedom for the Buddhists, because in those days there was a Roman Catholic regime, and Buddhism, though it was the religion of the majority of the people, was practically prohibited. And I did come to know quite a lot about the situation there, because I had staying with me beforehand and at the time a number of Vietnamese monks staying with me, that is to say, in Kalimpong. And I had become aware of the situation sometime earlier when one of the monks, who is now the rector of the university, Buddhist University in Saigon, translated one of my own books into Vietnamese. He happened to be staying with me, and this was in the middle 50s. He happened to be staying with me, and he translated into Vietnamese from English a short biography that I had written of Anagarika Dharmapala, who was the founder of the Mahabodhi Society of India and Mahabodhi Society of Ceylon and the reviver of Buddhism in modern India. And he told me that when he went back to Vietnam in a few months' time, he'd get it printed and published. So when I saw him again about 6 or 8 months later, I naturally inquired, "What about my book? What about your translation?" And he said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, it could not be published." So I asked, "Well, why is that?" He said, "I'm afraid the local Catholic bishop has prohibited it." He said, "We are not free in our own country. Buddhism is the traditional religion, but we are not free." And sometime later, you may remember, Buddhists in Saigon wanted to celebrate Buddha Jayanti, the Buddha's birthday, and were not given permission by the Catholic authorities. They were not even given permission to fly the Buddhist flag. And that upset them, because only a few weeks earlier, the Cardinal Archbishop's birthday had been celebrated, and the Vatican flag was flying everywhere. But the Buddhist flag was prohibited, and Buddhists were not allowed to take up processions in the streets of Saigon on the Buddha's birthday, on the Buddha's enlightenment day. Not only that, but all the major educational institutions were, of course, Catholic. And if you wanted admission, well, you had to become a Catholic. You couldn't just go as a Buddhist. Huh? And Buddhism was systematically discouraged, not to say persecuted, by the Diem regime. So these monks felt that there was nothing that they could do except draw the attention of the whole world to the fact that Buddhism was suppressed and persecuted in Vietnam by the dominant Catholic minority by this very dramatic action of sacrificing themselves. And this was the reason, the immediate reason for it. They just wanted religious freedom in Vietnam for Buddhism. But the background, the, we may say, ideological background, or even spiritual background of their action, was provided by this chapter of the White Lotus Sutra. We mustn't forget that Vietnamese Buddhism is a branch of Chinese Buddhism. And in Chinese Buddhism, and therefore in Vietnamese Buddhism, the White Lotus Sutra is very highly honored indeed. Vietnamese Buddhism, by the way, is rather interesting. We don't hear much about it, but it is rather interesting because it combines two major Chinese forms of Buddhism. It combines Chan, what we better know as Zen, with Pure Land Buddhism, what we know in Japanese terms as Shin. In Vietnam, they're traditionally a combination of Chan and Shin, which makes Vietnamese Buddhism rather distinctive. It's also interesting to note that not only is the White Lotus Sutra highly honored in China, Buddhist China, and its cultural dependencies, including Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and so on, but at the time of their Bodhisattva ordination, Chinese monks and Vietnamese monks have to burn themselves. I don't know whether anybody has ever seen a Chinese or Vietnamese monk. They shave their heads, or nearly shave their heads, and when the head is shaven, you will see on the crown a number of scars. There may be five, there may be seven, and so on. A number of scars. And they have these scars because when they are ordained, they get first of all the monastic ordination, then the bodhisattva ordination. When they're given that second ordination, the bodhisattva ordination, pellets of perfumed wax are placed on their heads, and then they are lit. And mantras and prayers are chanted very, very loudly, and they kneel with their head, their crown, as it were, on fire, and these five or seven pellets of scented wax have to burn down into the scalp. Some say it's very painful, but they bear the pain, they clench their fists, they try to concentrate on the mantras, and in any case there's a very loud chanting going on from everybody present. Some say they don't feel anything at all, but they all go through this ceremony. And the next time our friend Tien Chau comes to London, he being a Vietnamese monk and friend of mine, if he is well shaved, and he's very short so you can look quite easily, you'll notice that he has these scars, as every Vietnamese monk and nun, and every Chinese monk and nun also has. And this tradition derives from this particular chapter of the White Lotus Sutra. And I remember that when I was in India, I knew a Chinese monk used to burn himself all the time. He lived at Kusinara, where the Buddha passed away, and he lived in a tree. He never came down. He lived in a tree. He lived up the tree on a little platform, and he lived there all the time. People brought him food. And every few days, he'd put a candle on his arm or some other part of his body, light it, and let it burn down into the flesh. And he was covered with burns. Now, I'm not saying this is very Buddhistic. I'm just citing it as an example or an illustration But it's rather interesting that the Buddhists thought he was rather going to extremes. They weren't quite happy about him. But he was very, very highly venerated by all the Hindus in the surrounding villages. They thought he was a real holy man. And they weren't so impressed by the other Buddhist monks who didn't burn themselves in this way. So we can understand now that the action of those Vietnamese monks who burned themselves and the form that that action took, the form that their protest took, was not arbitrary. We can see it, we can understand it now against a background of tradition, the Chinese Buddhist tradition, which includes the White Lotus Sutra. And not only that, we can understand that their action is even a reminder to us. It's a reminder to us, essentially, that we should be prepared to sacrifice life, even, for the Dharma, if necessary. And it's very easy for us to forget this, because we, frankly, have it so easy. In some countries today, it's very difficult to follow a religion, using that term just for the sake of convenience. There are some parts of the world where it's not easy to be a Buddhist, not easy to be a Christian, and so on. You're driven sort of underground. You live in fear of a knock on the door. But here we can just follow anything we like, this religion, that religion, any religion, no religion, do as we please. So we don't always appreciate our good luck. We don't always appreciate the rights that we enjoy. And so therefore we become a bit lazy, we become a bit indifferent. We don't take it all very seriously. And maybe we're not always aware of the fact that we could, under certain circumstances, be placed in a situation where we had to choose between our religion or death. So perhaps this is the real meaning of this Baisharja Raja chapter of the White Lotus Sutra, whether it's a later incorporation or not. What it really means is, what it really asks us is, are we prepared, if circumstances require, even to give our life for the sake of the principles, the spiritual principles that we believe in? It's not a question of throwing away our life, not a question of making some grand, spectacular, theatrical gesture, but a question of whether we are prepared or would be prepared to stick to our principles, even at the cost of life itself.